In our lesson this evening, we are going to be studying purging out the old leaven. The elders thought that it would be an appropriate time to discuss this subject, since this action was being taken this evening. This expression, purging out the old leaven, is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 5, and we'll be looking at that tonight, but we're not going to be looking at it now particularly, except to point out that this expression is found in that verse, in that chapter, verse 7. Purge out the old leaven, that ye may be a new lump, even as ye are unleavened. And in the context, it was referring to the actions of a man who had taken his father's wife to be his own wife, was therefore living in a situation of fornication such as was not even found among the Gentiles. So we're going to begin our lesson by using this as our title, if you please. And the New Testament teaches that occasionally the church must take steps to purge itself of those who will not be faithful. And we have had to take that step today. We've had to do that at other times. First of all, let's deal with the objection, that's judging. I really wish that in this, as well as all other things, we could grasp a very genuine concept of the New Testament church, that we are the New Testament church, that this is not just something we're going through. It's not just a ceremony. I wish we could feel an identity with the New Testament church. I think we need to do that. We ought to do that. And the things that we're saying tonight come from the New Testament, and they have to do with the church that was back then. So as we look at this, let's realize that sometimes this is an objection that people make. Very often, it is difficult to handle this right. In other words, the most common criticism you'll ever hear is, well, I don't think that was handled right. I don't know if there is any right way to handle it. In other words, a way that will just make everybody happy. It is not a happy time. It is not a happy time. And naturally, it's an unpleasant situation. But the point that we're going to be making is that the New Testament teaches that this kind of thing must be done. And so this is an objection that's sometimes made, and I want us to deal with it. That's judging. Often the first response that is made to the action of withdrawal is a condemnation of the judging that's going on. And it is pointed out that Jesus taught that we are not to judge, and that he himself said, let him that is without sin among you cast the first stone. So let that register for a moment. Now these are the things commonly said, that we don't have any business judging. And Jesus said, let him that is without sin among you cast the first stone. Well, there are other verses that teach that we are not to judge our brother. In James chapter 4, verses 11 and 12, he said, speak not one against another, my brethren. He that speaketh against his brother and judgeth his brother speaketh against the law and judgeth the law. And he said, but if thou judgest the law, then thou art not a doer of the law, but a judge. One only is lawgiver and judge, even he who is able to save and to destroy. But who art thou that judgest thy brother? So we may also read that passage. But then, what do we have? Unless we want to accuse the Bible of being hopelessly contradictory, we have to reconcile these statements. Although it is true that Jesus said, judge not, Matthew 7, verses 1 and 2, he did so in a context that emphasizes hypocritical judging, an attitude that sees everyone else's faults but fails to recognize his own. That was the very context when he talked about one who would say, here, let me come over and get that speck out of your eye, when he has a beam in his own eye. So that the context deals with a kind of judging. Judge not that ye be not judged. James says the same kind of thing. But in the same chapter, Matthew 7, Jesus also warned of false teachers and said, "By their fruits ye shall know them." Now, as we go through this, we're going to see that on the one hand, we've arrayed the passages that sound like we're not to judge. But we're showing that in the very context of those passages, like Matthew 7, Jesus is laying upon us that very responsibility to be able to examine evidence and to make a decision on the basis of that evidence. That is something that God has required of men throughout all the ages. He requires it of us personally. It is required of societies in their courts, in all kinds of things. This is very, very common. So Jesus said in Matthew 7:16, regarding false teachers, "By their fruits you will know them." So that means we have to be able to observe teaching, behavior, and make a judgment about that. Now, Jesus also said, "Let him that is without sin among you cast the first stone," in the story of the woman taken in adultery. Now think about that story. Did Jesus mean to do away with the law? There are other passages, but I picked out particularly Deuteronomy 22, verses 21, 22, and 24, all of which state that when someone is taken in adultery, they are to be stoned to death. That's what the law said. Now, it is interesting that in those verses, that it's not only the woman, but the man. They're both to be stoned to death. That's what the law had said. Now, was Jesus meaning by his statement to do away with the law? Now, this is the one who said, "I came not to destroy the law, but to fulfill it." So, are we to think that, on the one hand, Jesus was saying, "I do always uphold the law of Moses," and on the other hand was saying, "No, we don't have to do what it says"? Now, can we believe that? If we believe that about Christ, what does that make Him? It makes Him hopelessly contradictory, and He does not deserve any respect or any of our attention if His thinking is that way. But no, Jesus did not mean to do away with the law. The case was one in which there was great hypocrisy and insincerity on the part of the Jews, and they were merely using this woman as a pretext to discredit Jesus. Therefore, their concern was not to uphold the law. Their concern was not to deal with the wrongdoer. They had none of those legitimate concerns. Their only concern was to discredit Jesus. Jesus Himself taught that if one will not make correction, then let him be as the Gentile and the publican. So for Jesus to say that, He could not be saying that there is never a time for you to make a judgment. In this case, He said, "Let him that is without sin cast the first stone," because He knew that those Jews were not there in their sincerity and in their own righteousness. They were there simply trying to find fault with Him. That's why He said that here. But He was not meaning to conflict with the law. He was certainly not meaning to conflict with Himself, who Himself said that if you go to a brother who has offended you and try to get it straightened out, he won't do it. You take two or more with you, he won't do it. You tell it to the church, he won't hear the church. Let him be to you as the Gentile and the publican. He was not contradicting Himself. And through His apostles, Jesus taught that at times His people would have to judge those who persist in evil. Listen to these very clear words of 1 Corinthians 5, beginning in verse 9. "I wrote unto you in my epistle to have no company with fornicators, not at all meaning with the fornicators of this world, or with the covetous and extortioners, or with idolaters, for then must ye needs go out of the world. But as it is, I wrote unto you not to keep company if a man that is named a brother be a fornicator, or covetous, or an idolater, or a reviler, or a drunkard, or an extortioner, with such a one know not to eat. Now listen carefully. For what have I to do with judging them that are without? Let's start over. Verse 12. For what have I to do with judging them that are without? Do not ye judge them that are within, but them that are without, God judgeth. So, through his apostle, Paul, Jesus was telling us there are times when we do have to make a judgment by looking at the evidence and then making a choice accordingly. But this does not mean that we are in the place of God. But God himself has commanded us to take the steps that we have to take from time to time. Therefore, the statements of Jesus condemning some kinds of judging are not to be taken to mean that the church is never to purge itself of wrongdoers. And when we go about saying, well, I just don't believe we ought to judge like that, we are putting ourselves squarely, diametrically in opposition to Jesus Christ himself. So be careful how we think and how we speak about these things. That we not put ourselves in a position where we are opposed to God, we are opposed to Jesus, and we are opposed to the very thing that they have commanded to be done. Especially when in our objecting, we are doing it in an illogical, unscriptural way that actually results in a contradiction between some things Jesus says and other things he says. And that cannot be the case. The second thing I would like for us to do is to look at the passages that are involved. And we're not going to turn all of these right now, but we're going to look at them as we go along. But I want to list them here. In Matthew 18, 15 through 18, this is the specific instructions of dealing with a brother that has sinned against you. Romans 16, 17 has to do with marking and avoiding those that have done wrong. 1 Corinthians 5, we've referred to already. 1 Corinthians 14, 37 and 38 has to do with one who will not acknowledge the commandments of the apostles as authoritative, as being from God. If they will not acknowledge those commandments, then they themselves are not to be acknowledged. 1 Thessalonians 5:14 talks about our admonishing the disorderly, supporting the weak, encouraging the faint-hearted. In other words, there are different appropriate actions according to a person's situation and spiritual condition. 2 Thessalonians 3:6, withdraw yourselves from every brother that walketh disorderly. Titus 3:10, a factious man after first and second admonition refuse. So here's a list of the passages. And now then, let's look at the various points that are made by these passages. First, there are different terms used for various aspects of this discipline that we're talking about. Withdrawing is not the only one. There is marking and avoiding. Different expressions that are used, but they all basically boil down to the same thing, a recognition of unfaithfulness on the part of the one concerned. It is a statement of the body of Christ regarding a member of that body who has behaved himself or herself in such a way that he or she can no longer be recognized as a faithful member of that body. So look at some of the different terms. And we'll just go over these fairly quickly. When Jesus said in Matthew 18, 18, that if that brother who has sinned against you will not hear, he will not make any changes, let him be to thee as a Gentile and a publican. In other words, a person who has been marked or withdrawn from is to be recognized as one who has no spiritual connection with God. They have no spiritual connection with God. That is, you know, the serious thing, by far the most serious thing, is not the action the church takes. The action is, or the most serious thing, is the condition that that person puts himself or herself in by the behavior that they've engaged in. That's the thing that is so serious. I have seen people all over who will do anything in the world they can to keep a thing from being known. It doesn't seem to bother them that they did it. It doesn't seem to bother them that God knows they did it. As long as we can just keep it quiet, they do not realize that spiritually the damage has already been done to them. And such a one has no spiritual connection with God, and a statement of marking, withdrawing, avoiding, all of that is simply recognizing the spiritual condition of that person that already exists. They have been delivered to Satan. They have been delivered to Satan. Now, there are a lot of weird ideas that float around about what that means. But I believe that what that means is that when a person says, I'm through with God, then when we take an action of withdrawing or marking and avoiding and all of that, what we're telling this person is that you are no longer in the camp of God. You are in the camp of the devil. You belong to the devil and you belong to his camp. It is a recognition of that fact. This delivering to Satan, that's what that's talking about. It is a recognition of the fact that they have abandoned God and they themselves have been abandoned to the devil. If they're not going to serve God, then whom are they going to serve? The devil. And so that's the idea that's involved in this delivering unto Satan. It means pointing out the fact that a person who lives an ungodly life has no connection with God. It does not mean... Such expressions, however, do not mean being rude or unkind. Rather, we are to regard such a one as a brother in our affections. Not recognize him as a brother in the sense that he has a spiritual connection with God. That would conflict with the things we've already pointed out. But to regard him as a brother so far as our esteem and our affections are concerned. Regretting and sorrowing for one who was saved and now is lost. And we need to feel that way. We need to feel that way about it. I want to turn to Galatians 6 and verse 1 and read that statement. It's something we all need to remember. Brethren, even if a man be overtaken in any trespass, ye who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, looking to thyself, lest thou also be tempted. This is the approach that we are to take. When you take that approach, it doesn't always work. Sometimes you cannot bring people back. People will be lost. But that's the way we need to go about it, trying to win them. Another expression is this idea of marking. Now, when you look up the word that is translated mark in Romans 16:17, it means to look carefully. It means to contemplate, not to put a mark upon. I think that commonly our idea has been when we mark somebody, that means that we tar them with a brush or something. That we mark them. We put some kind of a symbol on them, that we mark them in that way. The word does not mean that at all. What the word is saying is, we might translate it, notice carefully. In fact, the Greek word itself is the one we get scope from. You know, sometimes we'll say, we need to scope this thing out, you know. And that means we need to look at it very carefully. So that we need to be observant, we need to know what is going on, and when we observe behavior that is absolutely contrary to the will of God, when we observe unfaithfulness in action, we need to note it carefully. And then the passage goes on to tell what further action we are to take and turn away from them. So understand we've got two different things here. Mark means to notice, to scope it out. And then secondly, turn away from them. In other words, there is to be no social interaction with such a person. No, not even to eat with such a one. Similar are the words to have no company with, 1 Corinthians 5, 9 through 11. similar to the idea of turn away or avoid them. In 2 Thessalonians 3:6, we have the term withdraw. Note, what is to be withdrawn in that verse is ourselves. Withdraw yourselves, it says. Years ago, I had an elder that I respected a whole lot. At that time, I was a very young guy, and he was old, probably less than I am now. But at the time, he was a real good student of the Bible. And he made the point to me that what the Bible says we withdraw is ourselves, not fellowship. And yet, as I have thought about that idea through the years, I believe the Scriptures do justify the idea of withdrawing fellowship as well. Not just withdrawing ourselves, but I believe it justifies the concept of withdrawing fellowship. And the reason why I believe that that is a legitimate concept in the Scriptures is because of a statement in Galatians chapter 2 and verse 9. Listen to this statement. Paul says, "And when they perceived the grace that was given unto me, James and Cephas and John, they who were reputed to be pillars, gave to me and Barnabas the right hands of fellowship." They gave to me, they extended to me the right hand of fellowship. Now, what would have happened if James and Cephas and John had said no? Then that would have been a withdrawing of their fellowship. So if fellowship can be extended, it can be withdrawn. And so, yes, we withdraw ourselves from the standpoint of having no company with, of avoiding socially and all of that, but we also withdraw fellowship in that we withdraw our willingness to associate with a spiritual understanding that we are one in Christ. I cannot extend that fellowship to someone who is not in Christ. So James and Cephas and John gave the right hand of fellowship to Paul and Barnabas. And on the basis that it can be given, I believe that it can also be withdrawn. Now here's an interesting statement on the subject, a term. We're looking at terms that are used, all of which are amount to the same thing in the final analysis. 1 Corinthians 14. How about looking at that passage for a moment so that you can get the most out of this? 1 Corinthians chapter 14, 37 and 38. And we're going to focus on the expression, "let him be ignorant." Beginning in verse 37, Paul writes, "If any man thinketh himself to be a prophet or spiritual, let him take knowledge of the things which I write unto you, that they are of the commandment of the Lord. But if any man is ignorant, let him be ignorant." Now, translations will vary, and I would like to set forth what is the accurate idea set forth here in the verse. Let him be ignorant. I'm quoting now from the Expositor's Greek Testament. "But if anyone is ignorant," that is, of Christ's authority in his apostle, "he is ignored," or he is to be ignored. Just as Jesus said that he would refuse to acknowledge certain ones, like Matthew 7 talks about those who would come to him and say, "Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy by thy name and do other things?" And he said, "Depart from me, I never knew you." All right, in the context here, if any man thinks himself to be a prophet or spiritual, if he is making any kind of claim to be a prophet or to have a spiritual gift, and yet he does not acknowledge the commandments of the Apostle Paul as having the authority of Christ, then he is not to be acknowledged as a prophet or spiritual. You see that? That is the point of the passage. Just as Jesus said he would refuse to acknowledge certain ones, so his followers are to refuse to acknowledge those who refuse to recognize his authority. So if one will not submit himself to the will of God and the plan of God in his life and work, then that person is not to be acknowledged as a faithful child of God. Now let's look at procedures in discipline. First, clearly, there are efforts to warn and admonish. For this we go to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. 1 Thessalonians 5:14. And we exhort you, brethren, admonish the disorderly, encourage the faint-hearted, support the weak, be long-suffering toward all. Now, there are a number of things included in that passage having to do with the treatment of people in various circumstances. First, we are to be long-suffering toward all. That means disorderly, faint-hearted, weak. But the disorderly are to be warned. The King James says, the unruly. Warn the unruly. Encourage the faint-hearted, the one who is not very strong. Support the weak, the one who is lacking in courage and the one who is not very strong. Support them. Work with them. Sometimes the matter of going to someone in private is pointless because the sin has already become notorious. There are those who will jump on this and use it as some kind of a defense as if it makes the whole action invalid. Take 1 Corinthians 5 as a case in point. In 1 Corinthians 5, is there any place that Paul says to the Corinthians, now you people need to go to that fornicator and you need to talk to him privately? No. And the reason why there is no need to do that is because the sin is a notorious sin known far and wide. And Paul says it is time to deal with it and deal with it now and deal with it quickly. So, yes, we need to warn and admonish, but then sometimes the sin has already become notorious. And then what is needed is public action. Public action. Because we go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and listen to verse 4. In the name of our Lord Jesus, ye being gathered together. You hear that? Ye being gathered together. That means this is a public action to be taken by the body. Taken by the body as a whole. Dealing with one of its members. Now then, what's the purpose of such actions? First, to purge the church of the leaven of evil. Leaven being influence. You take a church that never withdraws from anybody. A church that never exercises any discipline. A church that never takes any position on whether a person is faithful or not faithful, or whether any teaching is right or wrong or anything else. Take a church that doesn't take a stand on such issues, and that church will be a sick church. And it will draw to itself all stripes of people of all ideas. And you know, the ironic thing is that a lot of people today think that is the very ideal kind of church to have, where everybody can come no matter what you believe. Well, if we were going to have one like that, we might as well go for the Unitarian. I think it's about the widest one. You can be there if you believe nothing. But that is not the church I read about in the New Testament. So we must be concerned about this influence. A second purpose is for the destruction of the flesh, that the spirit may be saved. In other words, the hope is that by that person being abandoned spiritually by brethren because of conduct, that they may be brought to see the peril of their way, and they may be brought to see the sin of their way, and will want to make things right with themselves and come back to the Lord. And as a matter of fact, that is exactly what happened with this individual here that was withdrawn from. We find in 2 Corinthians he did repent. And so the flesh was destroyed. His fleshly way, his fleshly inclinations were destroyed. Here a man had given in to the flesh and was involved in a situation of fornication such as was not even known among the Gentiles. I'd say he was very much in the grip of the flesh. But he was successful in putting to death the flesh when these actions were taken against him, and he repented and was restored to the Lord. That's what this is talking about. The purpose of such actions is that he may be ashamed. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 14, "And if any man obeyeth not our word by this epistle, note that man that ye have no company with him to the end that he may be ashamed." Sometimes we are too concerned with whether the action worked. What God says do always works. It accomplishes the Lord's will, even when it is not the thing that we might like. When we do what God has said, then it accomplishes His will. It may not succeed in bringing the person back, but it does accomplish the will of God one way or the other. Either purging the church and keeping that leaven out, and or bringing that person back. But in either case, it is not ours to say, "Well, I don't think it works anymore to do that, so let's don't do what God said." And you know, we get to doing that, we get to thinking about the various things that God says, and we begin to pass judgment and say, "You know, I don't think that works anymore. You know, I don't think that works anymore." And pretty soon, we've just quit doing everything God says do, because we decide it won't work anymore. We may be like a Jeremiah and preach and preach and preach to our generation and not get anybody to listen. Have we failed? Was Elijah failing in the day when he felt that he was all alone? No, he was not failing, and Jeremiah did not fail. So we must learn to be satisfied with doing what God says for us to do, doing it as He teaches us to do it, and then let Him worry about bringing the crop up. What sins are subject to withdrawal? I remember back when I was a young preacher, I spent some time with other preachers. Boy, we hashed that over. And you know, I never could come up with a good answer to that. The reason why I couldn't come up with a good answer to the question was because it was the wrong question. Very often you have trouble answering a question, and it'll be because it's the wrong question. It is not the matter of a certain class of sins. That's not the point. But it is an attitude. It is a hardness of heart that is involved in whatever sin it may be. Look at some of the attitudes in these verses. Titus 3:10, a refusal to make correction. A refusal to make correction. When a person is involved in wrongdoing, whether it is regarded as serious or not serious, so far as men might look at it, if they refuse to make correction for that and persist in the sin, then it is subject to withdrawal. The attitude to refuse to hear, to refuse to receive rebuke, or a refusal to acknowledge the authority of Christ. Now, what sin are those talking about? Well, you think, what sins could be involved in a refusal to make correction, or a refusal to hear, or a refusal to acknowledge the authority of Christ? Well, I don't know any limit on what sin that might be. We are not capable always, as human beings, of even detecting the sin that a person may be involved in. And therefore, there are some things we won't be able to deal with because we will not be able to know. Those things we have to leave in the hands of God. It is true that some sins are specific in some of the passages dealing with discipline. For example, division and faction. Romans 16:17, "Mark them that cause divisions among you." Titus 3:10, "The factious man, after the first and second admonition, reject." Gross immorality. The gross immorality of 1 Corinthians 5. But sins are not specified in Matthew 18. What kind of sin might a brother commit against another and it not be something that needs to be dealt with? Do we know how to exclude what that might be? No. In 1 Corinthians 14:37 and 38, what all might involve a person not acknowledging the authority of Christ through His apostles. What all might do that? How could we exclude certain things from that? 2 Thessalonians 3:6, withdraw yourselves from every brother that walketh disorderly. Now I want to look at that word disorderly, because some say that because that occurs in the immediate context there of refusing to work, that that is specifically what disorderly means. Well, even if it did mean specifically that in that context, that doesn't mean that's what it means elsewhere. Let me show you. The word disorderly is not found only in the context of 2 Thessalonians 3:6. It is also found in 1 Thessalonians 5:14. In both passages, the word or the concept of disorderly is found. Now, in 1 Thessalonians 5:14, do you remember what Paul said there to do to the disorderly or the unruly? He says, admonish them. That means warn them. Now then, the question, what to do with the disorderly when he will not be admonished? Going back to 1 Thessalonians 5:14, what is disorderly there? What does it include? What is excluded from it? You can't see in the context of 1 Corinthians 5:14 that there's just one disorderly kind of a thing involved. It's the whole idea of being disorderly. Disorderly means to be out of step. It really means like here are the ranks of the troops. They're drawn up and they're marching together. And here is one who's over here going the opposite direction, a Gomer pile, as it were. And he's just out stumbling around and he's walking the opposite direction. He's out of step with the rest. And of course, it's not being out of step with men. We're not talking about that. We're talking about God's order, what God has commanded, and what He wants to be done. Disorderly compared to that. Another word, the factious man of Titus 3 and verse 10. Consider the meaning of factious. It comes from this word, which is pronounced in Greek, hairesis. It is the word we get heresy. It is the word we get heresy from. Now listen, this is fascinating to me, and I hope it will be to you, as I think about the factious man of Titus 3:10. The word is defined as the act of taking, capture, of a city, for example. Thus it is the false teacher who seeks to take people in through his false teaching. That's what the factious man of Titus 3:10 is. Titus 3:10 is not talking about a man who is hard to get along with. That is not what Titus 3:10 is talking about. Titus 3:10 is talking about a man who seeks to capture the minds of people, to persuade people, and to persuade them to believe his false teaching. That's what a factious man is. And Paul says after the first and second admonition, reject him, because he's a dangerous man. But what doctrines are involved in what the factious man might teach? Not a word said about, well, it's not this and it's not this and not this. It's only these two things. It's only these three things. There's nothing like that. There are no limitations like that here. Now, when it talks about that factious man, it is not talking about a man who merely holds a conviction of his own or who very tentatively offers an opinion. Telling, now I don't know about this. This is one idea I've thought about. But rather, it is one who actively teaches a thing and seeks to persuade others to believe it. That's what a factious man is. Now what I've tried to do in these last verses here is to show you that yes, in some context we have some specific sins mentioned in connection with withdrawing. But in other contexts, We do not have specific sins. There are no limitations like that. So we conclude, in both Old Testament and New, God has always had His people to cut off those who do not follow His ways. In the Old Testament, there were many specific transgressions for which the penalty was death, or a soul was to be cut off, separated from Israel. And this was at the time when Israel was a civil nation as well as a spiritual one. Now we do not have the power of death over someone, and I certainly would not want such power. We are a spiritual nation, but still God expects His people to walk in His ways and to purge those who will not do so. And so those are the facts. This is what the Bible teaches. And this is why we have done what we have done tonight, after years of efforts to work with this situation. But it's always a time to be sorrowful. And it is not a time to just say, forget it, give up. We need to continue to think about Denise, pray for her, and when we have occasion, to talk to her and admonish her and express to her the desire that we have that she get back with the Lord, that she destroy the flesh and come back to the Lord. Can you guess that I would much have preferred to continue my study this morning, tonight? That is a far more enjoyable, thrilling thing for me to do. But the Bible lays the necessity upon us of dealing with things like this. We need to train ourselves to accept all that the Lord gives to us and to respect it and to appreciate everything He has given unto us, because our loving God has a purpose in everything that He does. He has a purpose in this also. And let's remember these purposes as we have looked at them in the Scriptures. If you're not a Christian tonight, we want to encourage you to render obedience to the gospel tonight, right now. Because it is now. It's not because this is some kind of a sacred time, but it is now. And now is all you have. So if you're willing to become a Christian, we want to encourage you to do that. Come tonight as we stand and sing.